You're listening to the Department of Energy Joint Genome Institute's Natural Prodcast, a podcast about natural products and the science and scientists of secondary metabolism. Hey everybody, welcome back for another episode of Natural Prodcast. Right now, I'm working on this in the afternoon of the day I'm due to release it, which is not ideal for me keeping myself on my self-imposed schedule. So we'll have to see if I'm going to slip a day on releasing it into the feeds. Depends on JGI. But I'm trying, you guys. Schedules are hard. But I'm working on it because I really do want you all to hear this great conversation with Aaron Puri. He is an assistant professor from the chemistry department at the University of Utah, so that makes him one of Jackie's colleagues. Aaron is doing some cool stuff with cool bacteria that I'm really fascinated to learn more about. He works with methylotrophs, which are a group of carbon-fixing bacteria that I would say are still fairly unexplored in terms of their natural products chemistry. And he has a project with the JGI to synthesize the genes for and explore the chemistry of quorum sensing systems, specifically the acyl homoserine lactones. If you listened to Betsy Parkinson's recent episode, you've heard a little about these, and Aaron and JGI are working together to try to understand the enzymology of their synthases so that we can start to use the DNA sequence to predict or just understand better the language of microbial cell-cell communication. And he told us about his work in reverse stable isotopic labeling, an interesting way to explore biosynthetic chemistry. It's some fun topics, and I think you'll enjoy it. So that's this episode. I still have more stuff in the pipeline, including another recording made at Simbi, and any minute now you'll hear something I've been working on for what feels like forever. And we also recorded a proper introduction with Jackie and her work, so more natural podcasts to come. Thanks for listening, and enjoy our talk now with Aaron Puri. Jackie, we have one of your colleagues here today.
We do. It is very exciting to have Aaron Puri here with us, who's an assistant professor at the University of Utah in the Department of Chemistry, so welcome.
How do we introduce Aaron?
How would you like to be introduced, Aaron? I guess because you've had a little bit different introduction in natural products. So I might just start out by asking, you know, how'd you get started?
Yeah.
I know you're not classically trained originally in natural products. And so do you want to give us a little intro into just sort of what sparked your interest in getting into natural products?
Why are you here at Simbi?
Yeah. Thanks, Jackie. And thanks, Dan. I really enjoyed listening to this podcast, and Allison has done a really nice job of providing kind of that general scientific audience.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas now I'm sitting here with two people who know way more about natural products than I do, so it's a little intimidating.
Unfortunately, Allison's no longer with us, right? I mean, she's alive, but
oh.
She doesn't work at JGI anymore.
Okay, yeah, it got way more serious than I thought all of a sudden.
No. Allison is alive and well and doing very well. She's a real journalist now, not just working with me.
No, it's great. Yeah, so thanks a lot for having me. So my background's... I started out doing kind of, I think, what a lot of people would consider more straightforward chemical biology, a lot of which people classify as kind of tool building. So I worked with a really great guy named Matt Bojo in grad school, synthesizing activity-based probes, which are basically molecules that are that will covalently attach, so through a more permanent bond with their target, right? And so, for example, you could think of designing one of those that can trick an enzyme into thinking that that's its substrate. And then when the enzyme tries to turn it over, it'll become covalently bound to it. And maybe there'll be some sort of a affinity tag or a fluorescent tag. And so you can use that as a readout of activity. And I was really fascinated by that. And really kind of more generally from undergrad, the intersection of chemistry and biology.
Right.
But that wasn't quite where I could see myself going in the future. So then we were using these probes to look at host pathogen interactions, mostly with like enteric bacteria. And okay. I really fell in love with the bacteria part of that. And so I decided to completely change gears and go and do a postdoc with a woman named Mary Lidstrom at the University of Washington in Seattle. And she studies bacteria that grow on one carbon compounds like methanol and methane. And I really dove into microbial physiology and microbial genetics and really away from chemistry and, you know, synthesizing these molecules.
Okay.
And then what actually brought me to natural products was kind of reaching back into that love of the intersection of chemistry and biology. And it actually was jumping onto the integrated microbial genomes and metagenomes, the IMG platform that JGI has, that really got me into that, because we had these new genomes that JGI had sequenced that were of these bacteria that eat methane, right? So they can use methane gas as their sole source of carbon and energy. And it was before a group meeting, and it was like a nice summer day in Seattle. I think this was like 2013 or 2014. And Anti-Smash, I know you've interviewed Marnix,
yep.
Was out there. And so I had this new genome from JGI, and this is before they were integrated, right? Uh-huh, so I thought, you know, why not feed it in there? And went to group meeting and came back, and it was just so fun, you know, looking at this as someone who had a bit more of a chemistry background and thinking about what could be, you know, when you're doing this kind of genome gazing, right? And sure. All these... maybe the charitable way to put it would be like you're generating hypotheses, but it's really, I think, just like a fantasy, right? Mm-hmm. Looking at all of these different putative biosynthetic gene clusters in your organism that you love dearly and can genetically manipulate. And
yeah.
And so that's how I ended up here. So definitely not, I do feel like an outsider in this community, although, you know, both of you have been so, so wonderful. I think it's a really welcoming field, and I've really enjoyed that. And this is, one of only a handful of meetings, you know, especially with COVID, that I've been able to go to in the community so far. But, you know, being here and then being at the Marine Natural Products meeting in Ventura, where I got to meet you, Dan, mm-hmm. it's been a really cool group.
Yeah, no, I like what you say about the natural products community being welcoming, because that's my experience too. I mean, I think the really cool thing about the field is many people come at it from many different directions.
Yeah.
And if somebody brings some new approach or some new way of thinking or technology, that's usually very beneficial to the field. It's very, very, very multidisciplinary is the usual term for that.
It can be very question driven, right? It's not a bunch of people with who have hammers that are looking for nails. Everyone mm-hmm. is gazing at these beautiful nails and like trying to come up with different ways to
beautiful nails
or chasing each other with hammers.
Well, that happens sometimes too.
Yeah,
it's not as bad as it used to be.
Maybe I'm getting in at the right time.
Yeah. Exactly. For sure.
So you mentioned briefly this word methanotropes. Do you want to touch a little bit on that? Sort of what are these organisms?
Yeah, sure. So when we say a methanotroph, it is just an organism that can use methane as its sole carbon and energy source. But generally, we're talking about aerobic methanotrophs. So, you know, you think about these weird organisms, you think about methane gas, and oftentimes people's mind go right to anaerobic ecosystems. Mm-hmm. But these are actually, so methane, biologically produced methane, is produced from degradation of carbon in the absence of oxygen, right? But these are kind of the next step in the food web.
Okay.
So these are organisms, like if you think about, you know, maybe you're out kayaking and you drop your burrito and it drifts to the bottom of Mission Bay or something like that.
Okay.
And that, let's say it eventually ends up in the sediment, there's no oxygen, and that a lot of that carbon ends up as methane gas. As it starts to go back up through the sediment, before it'll get to this kind of Goldilocks zone where there's some oxygen available that has diffused down through the water column into the sediment. And the same thing happens in terrestrial systems as well.
Sure.
And so the methane is coming up from the anaerobic ecosystem, and you have some oxygen that is making its way down. And in that Goldilocks zone is where these aerobic methanotrophs would live.
So you mentioned briefly when you were looking at these genomes for the first time, group meeting, excited about this. And so you find these clusters, and one can think about when we talk about genome mining and organisms, a lot of times they're genetically tractable. Are these organisms, can you manipulate them, or can you move the genes and how to express them? Is there like a great host that you could use if you can't knock genes out?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the short answer is yes, you can genetically manipulate them. Most of the aerobic methanotrophs that people work with are actually alpha or gamma proteobacteria. They just have this very restricted niche, and they do need broad host range genetic tools so it's, you know, more complicated than working with something like E. coli, but it's doable. And that was a big part of my postdoc, was trying to make that a little bit easier. And that's something that we are trying to do in our independent lab now, is use these as a resource, right, for natural product discovery, because we can genetically manipulate them. I think that, you know, there's no reason not to look at as many different ways as possible to access the chemical potential of these or any organism. So developing good heterologous expression hosts, like, you know, maybe in many fields now, like in cyanobacteria or even coelacanth, right? It's much easier to port a biosynthetic gene cluster or a gene or group of genes into maybe the easiest quote unquote organism to grow within that same sure. genus. Right. Sure, sure. And so that's what we're trying to do right now, is develop sort of the chassis strains that then we can port things in to okay. as well.
Give us an example then. What's your favorite of these organisms? What's its name, and what kind of secondary metabolism has it got?
Yeah. Okay. So I think that my favorite one, and so a lot of this field started in England. And okay. so from my postdoctoral advisor, I'll say, instead of saying methyl, we'll say methyl. Well, so that's weird, right? Cause it's sort of a bastardized version of yeah. the two, cause we'll say methyl. So we call them methylotrophs. Right. This is like, every square is a rectangle, but not every rectangle is a square, right? So methanotrophs right. are methylotrophs, but methylotrophs more broadly can use other like methanol and things like that.
Got it. Okay.
My favorite methanotroph is Methylobacter tundra pollutum. And so the tundra pollutum part there comes, the type strain was isolated from Svalbard, Norway, like so right there by the Arctic Circle.
Okay.
But the strain that I ended up working with, and the one that I was just telling the story about that we put into Anti-Smash after, you know, downloading it, mm-hmm. Was isolated from Lake Washington. So it's really interesting that it was there in Seattle as well, just on the bottom of the lake.
Okay.
And so this goes back to that. One of the gene clusters that was in that organism identified or predicted by Anti-Smash was this group of genes. It was actually originally predicted to be a non-ribosomal peptide synthetase, but then flanked by these two genes that were annotated as a quorum sensing system.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I definitely would love to talk more about quorum sensing, but this is a way that bacteria communicate yeah. with each other and coordinate group behaviors. And so immediately, you know, like I said, we're making all of these hypotheses, or, you know, you're fantasizing about what could be going on here. And I knew very little about this field at that point. And the quorum sensing part was actually the easiest part for me to kind of get a hook on, because on campus at the University of Washington, there's a guy named Peter Greenberg in the medical school in the Department of Microbiology, who's an old colleague of Mary, my original postdoctoral advisor
okay.
as well. And he's actually the one in a paper from I think when I was like 6 or 8 or something like that, who coined this term quorum sensing.
Sure.
And so it was really cool to have an expert on campus. And so I emailed him and eventually got connected with a wonderful person who's a co-PI on a JGI project, mm-hmm. Amy Schaefer. So we've been friends ever since. She's a senior scientist who works with Pete. And, you know, they were really interested in looking at this cluster with me. And because it turns out that oftentimes in bacterial genomes, if you have a quorum sensing system or the genes that could encode for that right next to a larger biosynthetic gene cluster, the product of the biosynthetic gene cluster is regulated by the quorum sensing system.
Yeah, sure.
Exactly.
Sure, sure, sure.
So this is a very long answer to your question, but this gene cluster in this organism, Methylobacter tundra pollutum, is my favorite, and is kind of, again, maybe sort of highlighting the people-centric aspects of the broader field, and just going from one question to another. It's my favorite.
It's evolved.
Yes.
Very cool. Yeah, yeah, yeah. One of the things that I have observed in the past is that it seems like a lot of natural products are actually quorum sensing molecules, especially usually the simple, more diffusible molecules.
Sure.
You know, you suspect that they probably are used in cell-cell communications. Really, really important part of their ecology is these cells communicating with one another. What can you tell us about quorum sensing?
Yeah, so I definitely I think that there's a lot there, and this actually a great microbiologist named Roberto Coulter had this piece talking about how he thinks quorum sensing has it was a commentary about how quorum sensing has really captured scientists' imaginations because it provides a hook into how to think about something. It's anthropomorphizing a little bit here,
yeah.
But it allows us to kind of think about what the quote unquote purpose is for some of these things, right?
Right.
And you all know much better than me. There's a lot of people who talk about even antibiotics as signals versus growth inhibitory compounds or warfare agents, and there's no reason they can't be both, right? Sure. Depending on the concentration. So yeah, Dan, absolutely. I think a lot of different types of molecules can be thought of as signals or have other functions depending on their concentration and their context. Mm-hmm. When I refer to quorum sensing, I'm talking about probably one of the most well-studied forms, which is the form that uses these compounds that are known as acyl homoserine lactones. So again, podcast format, probably not the easiest to...
We'll put a figure describe. In the show notes.
Awesome. Thank
no
you.
No worries.
But so these are compounds that are mostly used by gram-negative bacteria.
Right.
And the system is pretty elegant, right? So these bacteria don't have eyes, but it's really nice to be able to... For them to be able to sense, I guess I'm anthropomorphizing a lot myself, for them to be able to sense how many of their kin are around them, right? At least from the sort of canonical way that we think about these systems.
Sure.
And there are many different group behaviors that would not be advantageous from a fitness perspective for these individual cells to be transcribing and doing unless there's enough of them around to affect their environment. So I think the classical example, is biofilm formation, right?
Yeah.
So you're producing different extra polymeric substances, but if there's only a couple bacteria or a couple of your kin around, you're not going to be able to make enough to adhere to your surface. And so you're going to have a huge fitness disadvantage if you're just kind of like constantly producing those things. Right.
Yeah.
So what quorum sensing allows you to do, it generally there's just three components in these acyl homoserine lactone based systems. So you have these synthase enzymes that can make the signal. Mm-hmm. You have the signal itself, which is again is the acyl homoserine lactone, and then you have a transcription factor that will bind that. And so at high concentrations of the signal, you get more bound to the transcription factor. These can diffuse in and out of the cell to a first approximation.
Sure. Yeah.
And then when you have enough bound to the transcription factors, they'll undergo a conformational change and go and sit down in the genome, and then they'll turn, usually I think most examples showed turning on groups of genes involved in behaviors, although there are certainly examples of them inhibiting behaviors as well. Uh-huh. And they can be things like biofilm formation. They can also be production, as we were sort of mentioning before, of more complex secondary metabolites,
right,
that an organism might want to use to affect its environment. I think that you could imagine if you have two colonies of bacteria in the soil or something, and they're competing with each other. If one colony doesn't have very many bacteria in it, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to be spending a ton of energy producing some sort of
natural. Especially a system like a non-ribosomal peptide synthetase.
Yes.
Like that's just the sheer amount of ATP that it takes to actually transcribe and translate all of those genes and you know, maintain them in the cells. That's a huge amount of energy, right?
Yeah.
So you don't want to waste that energy.
Totally.
Just willy nilly transcribing all your stuff.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. So if you can see why these are tightly regulated.
For sure. Yeah. So then they get expressed as the cells grow up. Mm-hmm. I don't know what is it, more density in the natural environment, I guess. Do these things grow as colonies or?
I think that.
I guess I'm trying to get at what is a methylotroph that's eating something that nobody else seems to be eating. What does it need, active compounds for?
Yeah. So I think that I think about this question a lot.
Okay.
And so my first part of the answer would be that there's actually a great deal of diversity within these methanotrophs, for example, that are using methane, which seems like a very specialized niche. So there's certainly going to be some competition there.
Okay.
The other thing, I'm really fascinated by looking at the field of cyanobacterial chemical ecology and all of that. So again, maybe it's a somewhat restricted niche there, right? But you oftentimes, cyanobacteria are wonderful natural product producers, and they're this linchpin, right, in this overall food web, because they're able to provide fixed carbon. And we see the same thing with the methanotrophs. And with cyanobacteria, I know that there's a lot to be said about for free living ones, this kind of idea that maybe they're gardening who is allowed to take up that fixed carbon, right? And it forms this food web and this community that may be in some way selected by the cyanobacteria. Mm-hmm. And I think something very similar could be happening with methanotrophs. The other thing is when you look at symbiotic cyanobacteria, you know, they're providing things for their host. They're providing fixed carbon, but sometimes they're also providing bioactive compounds for defense or things like this. And again, I think that this might be something that we also see with methanotrophs, which are also known to be symbionts of things like invertebrates, like mussels.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Very cool.
Yeah. Very cool. So I want to go back to these acylhomoserine lactones and these forms of communication. And so one can think of is that it's not one compound, right? We have many languages we use to communicate with each other. And one would envision that microorganisms have evolved multiple variations of these compounds. And exactly, so if you, you know, you're trying to figure out, you know, you have these clusters and maybe you have something that shows potentially it's regulated by one of these small molecules. How would you go about finding what that small molecule is?
Yeah. So you're first of all exactly right. One portion, the quote unquote tail of the acylhomoserine lactone can have different structures, and that is akin to what you're referring to, Jackie, right, as different languages.
Right.
And so it's really important because that structural diversity, it encodes for communication specificity, right? So it's important to be able to tell what language is being spoken. And when we look at the explosion of microbial genomes, we can see all of these quorum sensing systems, which again would just in many cases be these two genes for a synthase and a transcription factor receptor. And it's surprising, even though the first signal was characterized, I think in the 70s, it's still almost impossible if there isn't a closely defined homolog, a homolog that is very close that has been characterized to predict what molecule is being made. So, then you have to go in and tackle in different ways. So for your question, if you don't have access to the organism and to be able to culture the organism itself, we've been playing around as part of a project with the JGI with heterologously expressing those synthase genes in organisms like E. coli, and then being able to look using the metabolomics capabilities also at JGI. It's really cool that it's all integrated to see what molecules are being produced by those synthases. And now by linking a particular signal with a particular synthase amino acid sequence, we think that can be a great resource for the microbial ecology community to be able to better predict how their microbes are interacting with each other from sequence information.
Very cool. What have you learned?
Yeah, so the first thing I've learned is that when JGI gives you a ton of data, you better have someone really smart to be able to tackle it. Which fortunately we've been able to get some. I mean, the best part of this job, right, as an assistant professor, is all the wonderful people you get to work with. Both, you know, people like at JGI, but also people in the lab, right? So
right.
Yeah, so it's been really fun to take. So I guess to maybe describe in slightly more detail what the project that we are just kind of wrapping up now with JGI is, we identified using some different computational methods a bunch of different synthases that make quorum sensing signals, but we don't know what signal is being made. And so we picked a bunch of very diverse ones to try to learn as much about it as possible, starting with we picked 183 of them, and we sent that list to the Joint Genome Institute, and they were able to synthesize the genes for every single one of those and put them in individual plasmids and put those plasmids in E. coli. We were then able to express them and extract the supernatant and send that back to JGI and have them do untargeted metabolomics, which we can then, using some tricks to try to identify this particular class of compounds, these acylhomoserine lactones, we can try to identify what's being made. Mm-hmm. In some cases, it might be novel. In some cases, it might be a known structure, but we couldn't predict what was being made.
Okay.
And so now that's when I'm joking about having a lot of data, right?
It's
a lot of metabolomics data sets.
Yeah.
So what have we learned? So one thing that we've learned so far is that you can have very, very disparate amino acid sequences for synthesis that produce the same signal. So that's
okay.
So that could be an example of, say, convergent evolution.
Sure. Right?
But just speculating there. But it's interesting because, you know, you may not always be finding new chemical diversity, a new language, but you still can't predict what's being made, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing.
You would think you're probably limited somewhat by like the fatty acids or whatever the precursors that are available to the cell, right?
Yeah. So there's, you know, we can dive into the biosynthesis of these as much as you want, but so there's one class of the synthases that make these that you're absolutely right. The tails are fatty acid derived and from fatty acid biosynthesis. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you basically have your chain length and then some sort of substituent at the third carbon where you start to do oxidation. Okay.
There's another pathway? That's the one I remember from grad school.
Yeah, yeah. So the more recent one that they found, which has a lot more structural diversity, so that one uses acyl carrier proteins as co-substrate, right?
Right, right.
So the other ones, they use CoA substrates. So now you can use anything.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So those are the cool ones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're all cool.
Yes. Thank you. That's
you gotta love all your kids equally.
Yes. Yeah.
Just don't tell them that.
You can imagine you can have like one of the first one that was found, there is this p-coumarol, so para-coumarol homoserine lactone, right? So that was pretty amazing. Right now you have this aromatic ring, mm-hmm. Totally different kind. And yeah, they found out there's a CoA ligase that will take para-coumaric acid, turn it into a CoA, and then that can interact with a particular synthase and staple on the homoserine lactone.
Okay.
So the other thing about that class is that in kind of phase one of the project that we're doing with JGI is we're going to miss the products of those synthases. Mm. A lot of them, I think, because E. coli does not have the substrate pool.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So right. Sure.
In some ways, so to go back, you know, you're asking what have we learned? We one thing that we learned is this worked better than I think I maybe originally thought it would. So we were able to identify a lot of different kind of primary signals. And then we were lucky. One of the co-PIs on the project, his name is Dale Pelletier, and he's from Oak Ridge National Labs. He's an amazing microbiologist. And some of the synthases that we chose for JGI to work on, he has the native strain for. So we were able to take a bunch of native strains, and we're verifying that right now. Mm-hmm. So the story's not over, but we've been pretty happy with what we've been able to do. But, you know, for a phase two of the project, you're exactly right, Tan. These ones that, quote unquote, you know, failed the first round here, they may be the ones that have the most structural diversity in the signal, but it's just E. coli couldn't make them. So we can maybe go back into, you know, a chassis strain or something else. But this has been a really neat way, I think, in some ways quite reductionistic, but to think about heterologous expression for natural product production, right? Because it's sort of like one product, one gene, one enzyme here.
Sure.
Right.
Right. Right.
Which has been fun, because then we've been able to kind of blow out the scale a little bit for the project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you see a broader applications for understanding these systems?
Yeah. Are you talking about in terms of being able to predict quorum sensing signals from the genes, or are you talking about even more broadly than that?
Yeah, as broadly as you want to go. What's the bigger? Is there a bigger picture here towards this research, and what do you want to get out of it?
One of the really exciting things about the platforms that JGI offers is this idea of being able to do heterologous expression and mass here, right? So
yeah.
And I know that you all are working with a lot of people on a lot of different kinds of enzymes, right? So mm-hmm. I think that just getting to be part of that, kicking the tires for how does this all work? How does it integrate? How does gene synthesis integrate with metabolomics, right? And bring it all together.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be really exciting, and you're going to be able to do a lot more gene to function in the future. Specifically within, you know, what I'm passionate about here with quorum sensing,
right.
I just get really excited about microbial ecology. And, you know, you have your favorite bacterial community. For us, it's these methane oxidizing bacterial communities that we like to look through as a lens. And, you know, trying to be able to get to the point where people can predict what molecules are being used to communicate is really exciting to me, because, you know, maybe we could add some of those exogenously to change behaviors. Maybe we could target some specifically to degrade, you know, using something like a specific lactinase and modify behaviors to try to, you know, change functions in some human centric way.
Very cool. All right.
Great. You'll learn how to communicate with the bacteria.
Yeah, right. That's, you'll find me in the woods then.
So, you know, we kind of across, you know, covered quite a few different topics. And so right now, you know, what is an exciting project in your labs? You've kind of gone through like your history of chemical biology and introducing genome mining. And then you've got, you know, chemical metabolomics, looking at new chemical language. Yeah. And so I guess, is there something really fun that you want to, you know, a new area your lab is exploring?
Yeah, thanks. So
almost like, you know, that there is.
It's a planted question, Dan. So, you know, overall, I think what we're trying to carve out as our niche here is a lot of natural products labs look at maybe geographical diversity, right, to try to find new natural products. And we're certainly not the only people doing this, but we are very interested in looking at metabolic diversity, right, and new metabolic niches to try to find new natural products. So sticking with these organisms that grow on one carbon compounds, I think that there's an opportunity there to find natural products that, you know, may have been missed by companies like Pfizer or Wyeth or that, because they probably weren't isolating bacteria on methane gas during their time.
That's virtually guaranteed.
Sure. Yeah. Great. I have a job for a couple of years. But the other thing that we can do that we've been playing around with that is, we can take advantage of some of these metabolic sort of idiosyncrasies that these bacteria have. And one thing that we've been having a lot of fun with is what we've been referring to as, actually, this was a term that was first coined by Sean Brady and John Clardy, but at this inverse stable isotopic labeling. So, you know, in short, that this is basically this idea that when natural products chemists are interested in how a compound is made, they will oftentimes have a hypothesis that there's some precursor that's incorporated, and they can get some labeled version of that precursor if it's available, or synthesize it and feed it to the producing organism, mm-hmm. and then look for incorporation.
Right.
The problem is if that compound is not, that precursor is not available, sometimes you can be out of luck, right? Or it could be a whole grad student thesis to synthesize a 13C labeled version mm-hmm. of your compound. So people have been growing methanotrophs and methylotrophs on 13C labeled one carbon compounds, some of the cheapest 13C labeled substrates you can buy, right? So 13C labeled methane, 13C labeled methanol, for decades, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we've been doing is growing up our strain collection on 13C labeled methane or methanol. And now we have access to the whole Sigma catalog of precursors in their 12C form. You can feed those and look for incorporation in that way. And we've been primarily doing this through mass spectrometry right now.
Okay.
And so this has been really fun. You know, you could use this, you can imagine, to answer biosynthetic questions, but there's a lot of great groups that have also been using stable isotopic labeling to try to discover new compounds that incorporate a precursor of interest. So maybe you can find new biochemistry that way, or new derivatives of compounds. Or you can use this method to link gene to compound as well. And so the first way that we've been doing this, it goes back to quorum sensing, something that I like, because we know a lot about that system. And these acyl homoserine lactones I've brought up multiple times here, the homoserine lactone portion of those molecules always comes from methionine. So,
okay, right.
Right. So the first thing that we tried with this is we would grow up our bacteria on 13C methane or methanol, feed 12C methionine, and we were able to pull out the quorum sensing signals very quickly. So there's four carbons that are derived from methionine. You run two parallel experiments, one with 13C carbon source and the other with 13C carbon source plus your 12C precursor. You look for a shift of four, boom, it worked surprisingly well. So mm-hmm. we can identify quorum sensing signals that way, including ones that you may not know what the structure of it is, but by looking at the mass, you can imagine it would be a new structure. And so we've had some success doing that so far.
Right.
And then, so 13C methionine is available, right? This is just sort of our proof of concept. And where we're taking this now is kind of back to the way I started to explain this approach here is looking at precursors that are not available to, or in a 13C labeled form, at least that we are aware of. And so we've been doing that a lot now with like aromatic carboxylic acids, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about some stories that are going to hopefully come together, you know, relatively soon, since I'm an assistant professor.
No, it's exciting. I mean, it's a great way, and it really goes back to classical natural products of before we even had access to genomes, how you'd identify the pathways. You would do C13 labeling, you'd do, you know, C14 in some cases. And right. So it's going back to the basics and really learning about, you know, basic biochemistry and what we can glean from that.
Yeah, thanks. It's been really fun, and it's fun. You know, this isn't something we were working on when I started the job. It wasn't in my job talk, but it's fun to kind of see where it goes.
Yeah, yeah. No, it sounds awesome.
Very cool.
Aaron, thanks so much for talking to us today. This is really, really interesting to hear about. So much fun.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. Anytime. Thanks, man. I'm Dan Udwary, and you've been listening to Natural Podcast, a podcast produced by the U.S. Department of Energy Joint Genome Institute, a DOE Office of Science user facility located at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab.
And I'm Jackie Winter from the University of Utah. You can find links to transcripts, more information on this episode, and our other episodes at naturalpodcast.com.
If you like what we're doing with Natural Podcast and you want to hear more science from JGI and its collaborators, check out JGI's other podcast, Genome Insider, with my colleague Menica Wilhelm. You know, if you like what we're doing here, you'll probably enjoy Genome Insider too, so check it out. Our intro and outro music are by Jezzar.
Please help spread the word by leaving a review of Natural Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you downloaded it.
If you have a question or want to give us feedback, tweet us at JGI or to me at Dan Udwary. That's DanUdwary. I'm also on Mastodon with that name at mstdn.science.
If you want to record and send us a question that we might play on air, please email us at jgi-comms. That's jgi-comms@lbl.gov.
And because JGI is a user facility, if you're interested in partnering with us, we want to hear from you. We have projects in genome sequencing, DNA synthesis, transcriptomics, metabolomics, and natural products in plants, fungi, and microorganisms. If you want to collaborate, let us know. Find out more at jgi.doe.gov/user-programs.
Thanks, and see you next time.